I'd like to share a little reading by Albert Hofstetler called The Cure. We think we get over things. We don't get over things. Or say we get over the measles, but not a broken heart. We need to make that distinction. The things that become part of our experience never become less a part of our experience. How can I say it? The way to get over a life is to die. Short of that, you move with it. Let the pain be pain, not in the hope that it will vanish, but in the faith that it will fit in. Find its place in the shape of things, and be then not any less pain, but true to form, because anything natural has an inherent shape and will flow towards it. And a life is as natural as a leaf. That's what we're looking for, not the end of a thing, but the shape of it. Wisdom is seeing the shape of your life without obliterating, getting over a single instant of it. A number of years ago, I was speaking to another congregation, which at the time included a question and answer period with the speaker as a part of the Sunday morning service. And that morning, I had given a talk of mine called I Don't Have a Suit that has to do with our experience of feeling like an insider or an outsider. And during the Q&A, one woman was sharing with the congregation the pain of having to recently admit her elderly father into an assisted living facility, where she explained there was assigned seating in the dining room. Unbeknownst to my dad, she said, he got seated at the cool table. Because soon enough, one of the other residents rolled up alongside him and commented sadly, that used to be my place until you got here. Bad news, folks. It seems like in some ways we never get out of junior high. I attended Jefferson Junior High in Long Beach, as my father had some 30 years earlier. In fact, when he was 12 years old, he was on his bike across the street from the school, having wrapped up his paper route, late one Friday afternoon in March 1933, when the big earthquake hit, and he watched as his school collapsed into a heap of rubble. Far from rubble in my mind, Jefferson is a time and place that still lives so vividly in my consciousness, and like it or not, it was a shaping force in the person I would become and how I would come to see my place in the world. Yeah, middle school, junior high can be a potent time for many of us. A time of self-awakening and discovery, a time of getting one's bearings, for many a time of desperate yearning to belong, and yet always feeling the outsider. For some, a time of enormous cruelty, either as the victim or the perpetrator or both. And for some, a time of terrifying vulnerability. I was a gay 11-year-old boy when I started at Jefferson, and it was the first time I ever had to get naked in front of other little boys and shower together, suit up for PE. Gerald Colucci had chest hair in seventh grade. Some of the other boys clearly hadn't begun puberty yet. My God, my memories of those times, the people, the places, they're fixed in a 13-year-old's perceptions. And it can take years to tease apart those perceptions and begin to see one another, including ourselves, in a truly multidimensional way. Perhaps some of you saw the recent film, Eighth Grade. It is a devastating, achingly poignant portrait of this rite of passage shot through an utterly contemporary lens, and yet in some ways only going to prove the old adage that the more things change, the more they stay the same. In the film, Kayla's 13. She's enduring the last week of classes after a disastrous eighth grade year. Kayla makes these little shoebox time capsules, including a video time capsule, as a sort of gift and touchstone for her future self. She had made one upon graduating elementary school to the future middle school graduate, whom she had imagined would have it all figured out by now, and that life would be sweet. Well, this talk is the opposite of such a time capsule, in a way. Rather than reaching forward in time, I'm reaching back to a few specific characters at Jefferson, teachers more precisely, who are fixed in my mind in at most two dimensions. And if I dare to see them in a multidimensional way, what might I discover about myself? Did any of you ever find it nearly impossible to conceive of your teachers as human beings, living a normal life outside of the classroom. I mean, we might have known if they were married or had kids, but just couldn't quite wrap our heads around it. Maybe it's a function for those in my generation for whom teachers showed up to work in dresses, suits, and ties. It was hard enough to imagine them in casual clothes, let alone living a normal life. I remember how shocking it was to see Mr. Keller getting an ice cream cone at Thrifty Drugstore, or to see a teacher cry. Mrs. McCants was the first African-American teacher I ever had, eighth grade English. I simply adored her. I can still sense how disarming it was to see her openly weep in front of the class on Friday, April 5th, 1968, the day after Martin Luther King had been assassinated. It was impossible to conceive of the magnitude, the meaning of such an event for her, for any of us, really. I was coming of age in this narrow window of time in which assassinations had become the norm. It took decades to hold the magnitude of such events in a larger historical context. Well, several years back, Ted Authier, an old friend from the neighborhood and a fellow altar boy at Our Lady of Mount Carmel Church, sent me an email including a link to a then 12-year-old obituary for Claude Evans. Mr. Evans had been our ninth grade geometry teacher at Jefferson. Now, Teddy, who sadly passed away himself just last year, knew everything about everybody and every place that had been our world in Signal Hill and Long Beach during those years. Everybody should have a Teddy. I remembered Mr. Evans mostly as a big, bald, humorless, seemingly ancient man in his mid-50s, with a deep voice and bad breath and chalk dust always flocking the dark suits he wore, the residue of so many triangles and parallelograms drawn on the chalkboard. Mr. Evans also led the after-school slide rule club, if you can imagine. Dorkosaurus that I was, I showed up for the first few meetings with my little slide rule from Save On Drugstore, though I lost interest pretty quickly. But don't you know, when it came time to take yearbook photos for campus clubs, I and some of my friends showed up for that slide rule club photo. Hey, it was a chance to get out of class. We thought we were so clever. Mr. Evans is fixed in my memory as little more than a cartoon. And yet, when I read his obituary, I was filled with so much tenderness and regret for this man I never got to know, though I had spent an hour with him every day for a year. I didn't know he had served in the Army Air Corps, as my dad had during World War II. I didn't know he'd been co-captain of a Rose Bowl-winning football team from Berkeley. I couldn't have known that he lost an adult son in 1984. But the line that pierced the deepest revealed what I really didn't know. Anyone who knew Claude knew, most importantly, that he was one who would help anyone in need, and he would do so with kindness and warmth and a smile and no expectation of anything in return. The 13-year-old within me did not recognize this portrait at all and felt ashamed. The 60-something-year-old man only felt sorrow for this missed opportunity to connect, with an extra layer of sadness because the obituary was already 12 years old, as if that somehow solidified this was an opportunity gone forever. Much in the same way we might experience a different layer of sadness when we hear many years after the fact that someone we had known or cared about once had died. Leaves me wondering how little we ever really know of each other. Well, 20-some years ago, late in August, on a Friday afternoon, I drove down to Long Beach to meet an old college friend, Carrie, to go kayaking on the Alameda Bay. Carrie and I both grew up in Long Beach, went to the same high school. Though we didn't know each other there, we met a few years later in an engineering class at UCLA. But the Bay was a place that for each of us held these indelible, joyful memories of times growing up in Long Beach. So as we paddled around, we did a lot of, oh, I remember one time, and did you ever go over there? And you remember the popsicles they sold at Woody's Goodies? It was an enchanted afternoon. As the sun began to set, we turned in our kayaks, and though I was soggy and a little sandy, we walked down 2nd Street through Belmont Shore to go grab some dinner at a now long-gone Long Beach institution, Hoff's Hut. Even then, though, it had lost all the tacky familial charm we had remembered. It had become sort of slick and hip and corporatized. But as we were walking down 2nd Street toward the restaurant, I commented to Carrie, I have the strangest sensation that I'm going to run into somebody from my distant past. Isn't that weird? We go into the restaurant. I give the hostess our name. I turn around. I cannot believe my eyes. There is sitting my eighth grade gym teacher, Mr. Leinberger, the devil incarnate. Never quite like the other boys, gym class seemed only designed to drive that point home. And as if the other boys in class couldn't be counted on to underscore that difference, every single day, Mr. Leinberger could be counted on to bring up the rear. Esalen, you mean to tell me you can't jump over that? You couldn't make that basket? You couldn't run any faster than that? Go give me two laps. There he sat, still a large man, still with close-cropped hair, still with no neck, but now with a cane and a face slightly askew that led me to think he'd likely had a stroke. I pointed out the materialization of my premonition to Carrie. She whipped a camera out of her purse right away and said, well, you've got to go say hello. Quick, I'll take your picture. I knew she was right, of course, but not for any reason she would have assumed. I knew this was a threshold for me to cross, because I knew if I say hello to him, I will also have to come out to him, because sooner than later, a question will be asked about wife and kids. Excuse me. Are you Mr. Leinberger? Well, yeah, who are you? I reintroduced myself and offered my hand a shake. He took my hand and shook it, but he didn't let go. He pulls me down to sit next to him, not letting go of my hand. And for the next few moments, I was his captive audience. And I got an entire encapsulated version of the previous 40-some years. I heard all about the wife, the kids, the grandkids, the retirement, the stroke. And then he finally asks, so what about you, Mike? How many kids you got? None, I answered. Well, why not? What's your wife do? Okay, here we go. Well, I'm not married. I'm gay. I live with a man. I've shared my life with him for about 19 years now. The silence hung there in the air in a moment as awkward as junior high itself, while he looked around as if hoping someone would offer him a Q-tip to clean out his ears or something. Finally, he says, are you shitting me? No, I'm not. And again, the silence hung there. And I realized this, too, was a threshold. I realized that I had spent my entire life carrying a sense of apology for my difference, for being gay, making adjustments to everyone else's discomfort and to the awkwardness. And for once, I was giving it back. Here, you deal with it. And he sat and he fidgeted for a moment, then he finally spits out, well, that's okay with me, I guess. Gee, thanks. More to comfort himself than me, really, but just then the hostess called our name and we were seated for dinner, and that was that. But I have to say, during the entire meal, my heart did not stop pounding in my chest. I thought my chest was going to explode. For in that moment, he was not a feeble old man, and I was not an out, proud, 40-something, self-actualized gay man. I was 13, and I had just come out to my eighth grade gym teacher. Sam Sanders, the host of the NPR podcast, It's Been a Minute, recently observed that coming out is not just declaring yourself to the world. It's declaring yourself to each earlier version of yourself and letting that person know that they're cool too. Yeah, PE class was by far the most torturous aspect of junior high for me, and it all started day one, seventh grade. My teacher that year was Mr. Dennis. He was a short, affable enough man with a Detroit haircut, short flat top on top, held up with butch wax, long on the sides, combed behind the ears. Even in 1966, that haircut was a few years out of date. Mr. Dennis showed an obvious preference for the more athletic boys in class, and they returned the favor by affectionately calling him Coach. Well, day one, seventh grade, after the trauma of suiting up, Mr. Dennis tested us on how far we could throw a football, how many times we could hike it between our legs and hit the center of a bicycle inner tube hanging on a chain link fence behind us within some specified period of time. Well, I was a big sissy boy. I'd rather practice waltz steps out in right field than concentrate on any baseball game. I had never touched a football, let alone thrown one. I got an F. The first in my life. I can still feel the shame of being summoned into Mr. Meyer's office, the seventh grade counselor, and told I was to be placed in special PE. which was PE designed for boys with special needs, disabilities, handicaps, more commonly and disparagingly referred to as ortho PE. And the culture was such at the time that if you appeared to be able-bodied and were in special PE, you might as well change schools. You're just not going to survive. I confronted Mr. Dennis the next day. Did you recommend that I be put in special PE? Kind of ballsy when I think about it. He sheepishly answered yes. I think also kind of knowing he was also condemning me to a sort of social death sentence. But my only saving grace in the end was that the gifted math class met in the same period as special PE, and so math trumped out over football, and I was relegated to regular PE, where I spent a lot of time on benches, surreptitiously mapping out cha-cha steps with my feet tucked under the bench. The crazy irony is that very few years later, I began a career as a professional dancer. Physical agility, ability, coordination weren't my issue. But because I didn't fit the cultural norms of what a boy was expected to like, didn't excel at the things at which a boy was expected to excel, I was somehow seen as an affront to that culture, and I was labeled handicapped because of it. But you know what? I'm almost over it. In that same email that Ted had sent, including the obituary for Mr. Evans, there was also a link to an article about Mr. Dennis. This one from the Salt Lake City Daily Herald. James Dennis, 73, retired middle school teacher, former bishop in the Mormon Church, was convicted and sentenced to 20 years to life for the sexual assault and molestation of 17 girls, four of whom were his granddaughters. His son Gary's quoted in the article as saying that his father assaulted his first victim some 50 years earlier. That would have meant that Mr. Dennis's little enterprise had been well underway when he had been my teacher. Another close friend of the family was quoted as saying, "We were all so shocked. If only we'd seen something, maybe we could have done something to stop it." Yeah, the things we don't see. Almost more chilling than the headline was the mugshot included in the article. Of course, the Detroit haircut was long gone. And despite the now sagging jowls and the orange jumpsuit, it was most definitely my tormentor. Same cold blue eyes staring blankly at the camera with this expression that was not so much a grimace or a scowl so much as it was one of surrender. The jig is up. Complete and total disgrace. It was something to look at that picture. Now, if this headline had been about any other perpetrator, a stranger, I'm certain that my response would have been complete moral outrage and disgust. Lock the bastard up, throw away the key. And given whom he represents in my own biography, I might have thought there'd be another layer, a flavor of schadenfreude, if you will, delight in his demise. But neither was the case. I only felt deep, profound sadness. And I must admit that my sadness was not for his victims in that moment, but it was for him. Not only sadness, but even a kind of softness for the perpetrator of these crimes. And I'm left wondering about that sadness and about that softness. Here, this article in the Daily Herald confronts my 13-year-old perceptions of who Mr. Dennis was. Perceptions that had remained safely unchanged for those same 50 years. And as with each of these stories, I watched as those perceptions crumbled right before my eyes, just like Jefferson itself crumbled right before my father's eyes in 1933. Leaves me to wonder if such earthquakes aren't such a bad thing, metaphorically speaking, giving us a chance to reinterpret that which we thought was so solid and fixed. Giving us a chance to see through walls that hid things that should have been seen. It took 50 years to bring him to justice, after all. But I come back to why sadness? Why softness? Is it because, like it or not, Mr. Dennis and I did share a metaphorical minute waltz in the cosmic dance of our lives, and so he puts a human face on this inhuman deed? Is that it? Is it because of some deep, abiding sense in the inherent worth and dignity of all people? Maybe, but I don't think so. Could it be something approaching true compassion, if only for the complete humiliation, disgrace, demise of another human being? I don't know. I only know that I felt and I feel sadness. In the film, Eighth Grade, Kayla opens the shoebox time capsule she had made for herself upon graduating elementary school. And when she's confronted with the unmet dreams and expectations of her younger self, she finds it too unbearable. Overwhelming, in fact, she asks her father to be a witness to a ritual burning of the time capsule, not wanting to leave any trace of evidence of such unmet dreams. Even while her father plaintively asks her, "Are you sure? I know I didn't want her to burn it either." Now, if Mr. Dennis had made a time capsule for himself at 13, for himself at 73, it most certainly would not have included that mugshot, that orange jumpsuit. But then again, had I made one for myself at 13, for myself at 64, there is very little of my life that could have been imagined. The joy or the pain of it. I certainly could never have imagined being a chaplain. Possibly most inconceivable in 1966 would be that I'd be sharing my life with Scott for 41 years as an out, proud, legally married gay man who still can't throw a football. So what about you? What might your 13-year-old self have imagined about you today? What, if anything, would you have to say to him or her? Might those earlier versions of ourselves know deep in their bones that they're cool too? May there be love. May there be compassion. May there be room for all of us at the cool table. So be it. Thank you.